I'm Steve Kresge, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Plenty of folks are after Representative Kevin Yoder's job. No fewer than six Kansas Democrats are pursuing a chance to take him on in November's general election. But before that, they've got to win the August primary. Today, we'll meet two of those six Democratic candidates, Tom Nierman, a longtime teacher, and Mike McCammon, a former tech executive. Then, 50 years and a day after his assassination, we recall Robert F. Kennedy's last trip to Kansas in March of 68. Kennedy was kicking off his presidential campaign, but would be killed less than 3 months later. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. I'm Steve Kresge. Democrats think U.S. Representative Kevin Yoder of Kansas is vulnerable this fall, and they're clamoring to challenge him. So far, six Democrats have filed to take on the four-term congressman. We'll talk with two of them today. Later, we revisit a campaign stop that Bobby Kennedy made in Kansas just weeks before his assassination in 1968. But first, let's get a check of what the KCUR newsroom is following today. For that, let's bring in KCUR's Kyle Palmer. And how are you?
I'm doing well, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. Voters are going to the polls in Kansas City's Northland today. What are they voting on?
Well, this is a special election for Missouri's vacant seat in its 17th Senate district in Clay County. This is an election that's pretty interesting. It pits two popular state representatives against each other, Representative Kevin Corlew, Republican, and Democrat Lauren Arthur. They're vying to replace GOP Senator Ryan Silvey, who stepped down earlier this year to take a seat on the Missouri Public Service Commission. So this has been vacant for a few months now. Our own Brian Ellison has called this one of the last true swing districts in Missouri. It's not a particularly partisan area or partisan district, at least based on past electoral results. You could say it leans Democratic, but it's elected the GOP Ryan Silvey the last two times. There has been a lot of money, attack ads, and attention brought to this race, just mainly because it's the only game in town right now. And I guess by happenstance, it's also the first election to come up since the resignation last week of Governor Eric Greitens. So political analysts are saying this could be a bellwether of sorts to see how voters are feeling about the two parties in the wake of all that. But I will say the tumult in Jeff City certainly is on some voters' minds. Here's one voter, Stephanie Chalmers, who was voting at Good Shepherd Episcopal Church on Choteau Drive earlier this morning.
I mean, there's all with all the scandals and accusations and stuff, it's just ugly. And we need to do something. We need something else.
And Stephanie Chalmers not the only voter saying that this morning. So we'll keep tracks of that. Polls stay open until 7 tonight.
Okay. Also at this hour, City Councilwoman Alicia Kennedy making what she calls a major announcement in downtown Kansas City. What's that about?
Well, Alicia Kennedy saying she is unveiling what she calls her Grow KC Together initiative. The particulars about this are fairly vague at this point. We do have a reporter there right now, and she's actually set to start talking about this pretty much as we speak. She says in a statement that it's a plan to address issues facing KC's urban core. We'll say this is the type of big splash initiative that a lot of Kansas City Council members right now are trying to initiate to put their name on because Mayor Sly James is leaving, and already several council members have announced their plans to run and replace him in 2019. You have Mayor Pro Tem Scott Wagner, as well as council members Scott Taylor, Jolie Justice, Jermaine Reed, Quentin Lucas. There's a local businessman, Phil Glenn, Attorney Stephen Miller. So, the field's already crowded. Now, Alicia Kennedy has not said that this is why she's making this announcement today, but we'll see what comes with this Grow KC Together initiative.
Okay, and finally today, Kyle, a new TV show called Kansas City is now in production for Hulu, but there's a catch.
Well, okay, so Hulu, this is the network behind The Handmaid's Tale, the very popular show right now. And so it's casting for a pilot of this show, Kansas City, which will, according to industry publications and websites, begin shooting in June. The catch is it's shooting in Atlanta.
Okay. Just our luck.
But we will say it's kind of an interesting show to keep tabs on. The casting website, Backstage.com, describes its casting call this way. We're looking for cast members for a series set in a future where the city of Kansas, I'll overlook that, is separated by a wall between liberals and conservatives. Talent aged 18 to 25 is sought to portray high schoolers. So
whatever.
You got a couple of sons between 18 and 25.
Here we go. This could be their launch. Eh? Yeah. That's KCUR's Kyle Palmer. Thanks very much. No fewer than six Democrats have lined up for the opportunity to take on Republican Congressman Kevin Yoder, who represents the district that includes Johnson and Wyandotte counties. But only one of those six Democrats can win the August primary and proceed into the general election. Today we launch a series of segments aimed at introducing those six Democrats to you. We'll meet two of the contenders right now who are running hard for the right to face Congressman Yoder. They are Tom Nierman, he's a teacher at Pembroke Hill. He also has taught at Blue Valley West High School and Shawnee Mission East. Tom, welcome. Nice to have you.
Good to be here, Steve. Thanks.
Mike McCammon has worked in technology for most of his career and helped found a nonprofit that became water.org. Mike, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with just the basics here, gentlemen. Why do you each want this job? Tom?
Well, I am running for office for a couple of reasons. First of all, this is my home. I was raised in Kansas. I'm raising my own family here in Kansas. And as a teacher who has given my professional career to service, I've seen an awful lot of what happens in our communities. I've seen just about everything you can imagine in a classroom. I've worked with students from a wide range of backgrounds in just about every conceivable setting. And in addition to that, I'm a candidate who has lived the experience of a lot of working families. As a teacher, married to a teacher, I know what it's like to work paycheck to paycheck. I know what it's like to look at those health insurance premiums and know you can't afford them. I've got personal experience as a teacher with gun violence among my students. So there are a lot of issues that are critically important to a lot of working families. And I get deeply frustrated that it seems as though every election cycle, we send professional politicians, we send those who are out of touch with what working families and the middle class are enduring. And I think it's about time that we have someone from the middle class represent the middle class.
Mike, how about you? Why do you want the job?
Well, similar to Tom in a lot of respects, but I'll just add a couple little bit more items to it. I think when I go around and talk to folks in the district, what I hear the most is that people are really frustrated with gridlock in our government. We can't get anything done. It's been almost 10 years since we've had a budget from the federal government. And so when I looked at my background, I thought, you know, I have a good experience of making things happen. And I figured we need to have someone there that has the courage to compromise, knows when to stand their ground. The other big thing that I've been thinking about a lot, and this was really top of mind over the last 3 weeks when Zuckerberg was on the Hill testifying in front of Congress, that we have virtually no one in Congress these days that understands the digital age. And we live in a digital age. This is no longer the coal age. This is the digital age. And we have so few people in D.C. that understand these issues. In fact, as you saw in the testimony, very few people in Congress even understand the business model of Facebook, let alone the technology behind it and how it affects our daily lives, our conversations, and, of course, even the 2016 election.
You know, I'm wondering, Mike, I'll begin with you on this one. What has Congressman Yoder done that's made the two of you give up sizable chunks of your private lives to run for this office?
Well, I would say that he's done very little. From what I've been told when I talk to folks in the district, you know, I look at his background and I say, you know, in the time that he's been in Congress, when I was at water.org, you know, we helped 1 million people get safe water. And I can't see any substantive legislation that he's passed that's really helped Kansans. And I've seen him also be on the wrong side of a lot of legislation. For instance, the concealed carry law, I can never say that word. Steve, can you help me with that? You got the radio voice. Reciprocity, is that right?
Pretty good.
Okay, pretty good for a try.
Yeah.
but that law, and of course the ACA as well. So trying to gut that without a plan. I don't see Kevin has done very much for the district. And when I talk to people in the district, I hear over and over again, they're frustrated with him. They're frustrated with the fact that he doesn't stand up to our president. Every week there's something new that they could say, hey, that what you just said is awful. And Kevin just doesn't do that. He kind of hides and does his thing. And I know Tom and I, both of us, actually everyone on the Democrat side, are frustrated with that. And we want to change. That's why we've decided to put our lives on hold and make a run.
Tom, what's your big beef with Congressman Yoder?
Well, I think that Congressman Yoder is very good at saying one thing, but his voting record indicates something else entirely.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that A great example is his vote for an appropriations bill last summer that cut over $2 billion for federal funding for Title I schools. And this is at a time when our schools here in the 3rd District are really struggling because of Brownback's tax experiment. And for people in the 3rd District, public education is a critically important issue. And Congressman Yoder will say it's an important issue for him. But then he'll turn around and vote for a bill that cuts federal funding to help our school, or federal funding that would have helped our schools that are struggling the most. And to me, it's that kind of duplicity that I find really disturbing.
You know, if he's so out of touch, Tom, why has he been elected 4 times to the U.S. House of Representatives?
Well, I think there are a couple of factors. One, I think Kevin's a very good politician. I think Kevin's very good at saying one thing, getting good photo ops, and then making sure that his voting record is one that that doesn't see the light of day here in the 3rd District. I think that's one factor. I think the other factor is that he's never faced really stiff competition. And I think this election cycle, there are a lot of people who are really frustrated with the current political landscape. And we've got a great opportunity to challenge him. And he's never faced a strong candidate before. And I think this is the time to do it.
What would you add to that, Mike?
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that is I would add that you know, the math of the Kansas 3rd District is that it's moderate and it's mostly Republican. The story I tell folks all the time is, you know, if you're a Democrat and you're standing in line at the grocery store, look at the person in front of you in line, the person behind you in line, and remember you're the only Democrat. And so when
although Hillary Clinton carried the district by a single point in 2016.
Against a very, very unpopular candidate for president on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that you can kind of coast on some of these things just based upon the math. And so, but we believe that the time is now, that people are very frustrated with Kevin. I think the time has run out for him. And of course, the president is just helping that conversation.
I'm visiting with two Democratic candidates for the 3rd District of Kansas, Tom Nierman, Mike McCammon. What kind of job has President Trump done, Mike? What would you point to? How would you evaluate him as president?
I would rate him rather low. The thing that I hear more often than not when I talk to folks, and I've been meeting with lots of leaders and teachers and students and moms and dads in the district, what they're most disappointed with, I mean, you've got the policies and you can argue about all that stuff and the reign of terror on the immigrant community. There's all kinds of awfulness. But where I go is to this kind of civility of conversation that we no longer have. And then I also would say this kind of saber rattling around, you know, a trade war, which is kind of changing the international climate for companies based in the U.S. and even people living abroad that are American citizens. So to me, the thing that's most disappointing to me is this lack of civility of conversation. And I think all of our leaders, not just our president, but the people that are in City Hall, the people that are in our schools, the people in our neighborhoods, you know, our leaders need to help us find a way to have civil conversations with one another, because that's why we have gridlock. People are unwilling to sit down and say, you know what, can I hear your side of the story so I can understand your point of view?
But the problem is that with incivility certainly predate President Trump, right?
They do. But I think, as you know, he's amped it up quite, you know, I mean, it's almost become, I won't say that term, that's a bad term to say, but it's really much more angry, much more lack of respectfulness. And just downright mean. Mm-hmm. It is, and you hear that a lot, particularly when you talk to some of the disadvantaged communities in Wyandotte County, that they feel very left out by the opportunity that the Republican Party is trying to portray in America today.
How about you, Tom? Your big beef with President Trump?
It's just about everything that President Trump has done. I've had difficulty accepting. Whether we're talking about foreign policy, we're talking about domestic policy, tax policy. But I think the part that I find most frustrating is the general instability that his tone creates. And I think that makes it very difficult for people to engage in helpful discussion that will result in policies that work for people in our communities. And the direction that Trump is taking political discourse, I think, is not helpful at all.
So what's your big issue, Tom Nierman? What issue would you focus on if you're elected to Congress in November of this year?
there are several issues that demand critical attention, and I hear these things repeatedly throughout the district. One is making sure that we are supporting public education. The other is making sure that we can create programs that allow working families to get access to health care. And then people want good-paying jobs. We've got a great unemployment rate. But wages have stagnated, and we need to make sure that we are creating jobs that will support working families.
How do you make wages go up?
I think one of the things we need to focus on is manufacturing jobs. And if we can create advanced manufacturing here in the 3rd District, I think that's a great opportunity. I think one of the other areas where we've got a great opportunity is investing in infrastructure. And we've already got plans at the federal level for massive infrastructure programs. And we need that infrastructure here in the 3rd District. And we know that infrastructure jobs create good-paying jobs. We know that infrastructure helps create the basis for a solid economy in our neighborhoods and in our communities. And I think that those two areas, advanced manufacturing and infrastructure, are ways that we have good-paying jobs that will support families.
You also mentioned the need for Washington to focus on education. The education part of the federal budget is fairly small. What does the federal government need to do on education and schools that it's not doing now?
I think there needs to be continued support for equity in public education. I mean, that's the responsibility of our federal government.
Meaning
that we do everything we can to ensure that regardless of what neighborhood a kid is going to school, that student has the opportunity for a first-rate education. And I'm always very proud that Kansas is ground zero for equity in education. We've got the famous Brown case that's here in Kansas. And I take that responsibility as a teacher very seriously, this idea that we provide valuable education to everyone, regardless of what neighborhood that a family lives in. But that's the function of education funding at the federal level, is to ensure equity, that every student has access to a good education.
Mike McCammon, what's your big issue?
Well, like Tom, there's a lot of them. You know, we hear a lot on the campaign trail that, you know, obviously folks want affordable health care. Obviously, we need safer gun laws, and that's obviously a big topic of conversation. Education, a lot of people caring about the environment as well. You know, we've been on record as our campaign of having pretty aggressive goals for migrating away from gasoline and diesel-powered cars for personal use. Equal rights. I mean, we saw that Illinois just recently passed equal rights amendment, so there'll be a big court fight after the last one approves it. I hear that a lot, and a lot of the issues around equal pay and all that kind of stuff is kind of tied up into that equal rights amendment, that if we get that passed, I think it's great. And we tell folks all the time it's amazing that we live in a country where gun owners have more constitutional rights than women. Doesn't make any sense. And then economy as well. The one last thing that I keep talking a lot about, because I keep hearing it more and more, to circle back to this, is, you know, what are we doing about the issues of our digital age around privacy, around identity, and around our security? I was talking to some folks in the banking industry, and what I discovered is that the banking industry is one of the most regulated industries we have in our country. Next would probably be healthcare. And then you compare that with the tech sector, and particularly social media, and it's virtually unregulated, which is why we see kind of the antics that we've seen in the election. And then I think, you know, Mark Zuckerberg goes on the Hill and kind of acts kind of complacent to the whole thing, which to me is very, very irresponsible, because the integrity of our democracy is at stake on some of these things.
Yeah.
And people just don't seem to be too concerned about it.
I'm visiting with two candidates for the 3rd District of Kansas, two Democrats, Tom Nierman, Mike McCammon, part of an ongoing series we're launching today with the 6 Democrats who are in this race. Let's turn to guns. Mike, you just mentioned that, and the ongoing concerns over school shootings across the country. Do you favor an assault weapons ban, and should teachers in schools be armed in this attempt to ward off school shooters?
Well, so to answer directly your question, yes, I'd be in favor of assault bans. I would be in favor of banning assault weapons. I'd also be in favor of banning all accessories that make guns battlefield ready, if you will. I do not think, I'm going to look at Tom here. We joked about this at one of the candidate forums. I don't want Tom packing a gun, just to let you know that. So I'm not in favor of teachers. Although I'm not sure they do that at Pembroke Hill. It might be kind of a different setup than the public school systems in our district. But So I think those are things. What I've heard over and over again when I've talked to folks is that the biggest hole is around the background check system. So you talk to the police department, you talk to gun shop owners, what you hear is that the system for getting weapons is very porous. And by the way, we should go on record. No Democrat thinks that we should take away people's guns. It's just that we need to make sure. In fact, you talk to gun owners, they'll tell you they don't want criminals or dangerous people to have guns. And so the gun show loop is there. And the background check system is quite porous and not complete. And so there's a lot of things we could do to actually tie that up to make people feel more safe.
You know, you favor an assault weapons ban, Mike, but most murders in this country are committed using handguns.
Yeah.
Do you have a separate plan to address handgun violence?
You know, not necessarily. You know, right after the Santa Fe shooting, you know, I went on record saying that it sounds like from news reports this could have been avoided by buying two things, and that were gun locks. You know, I've heard some people, which I'm not sure this is the right path, but I've heard some people suggest to me that maybe we should require insurance for gun owners, that if a weapon is used in an event, that they are held liable for that. And that, of course, would be a way to kind of encourage people to, you know, lock down their devices when they're not in use. Mm-hmm. I heard the statistic that when people commit suicide, those that survive it with a gun, they made that decision in the last 20 minutes to take that action. So obviously gun locks, particularly for teenagers, because that's actually one of the things that's really scary in the 3rd District and in Johnson County in particular, is teen suicide by guns. 20, by the way, in Johnson County since the beginning of the calendar year. Huh. You know, by taking out that spur-of-the-moment decision would save a lot of lives. People killed by guns as well as teens killed by guns, just by having gun locks.
Tom Nierman, how about you? Do you favor an assault weapons ban, and should teachers in schools be armed? You have a lot of experience in the classroom.
I do, and this is an issue that's deeply personal to me because I've had students of mine, the victims of gun violence. I've had a gun brought into my classroom. So this is an issue that is that's deeply important, and one of the things that should not happen is that we arm teachers. I think that there are a number of things that we can do. One is to make sure that we do ban the military-style assault weapons. I just don't think that they have a place in civilian society. But some of the places that we can begin are in closing the loopholes that we've got in our background checks. We can also make sure that domestic abusers forfeit their weapons. Those are ways that we can begin to make sure that our communities are safe. And one of the things that I've always been an advocate for is allowing the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, to study gun violence as a health safety issue. And I think we need to frame this as a health safety issue. And finally, the CDC did get the right to study gun violence. Now we need to make sure that it's got adequate funding.
We sit here and we have these very sober conversations about gun violence, Tom. Does it make any difference because, you know, will tougher gun laws accomplish anything? There's roughly, two guns in this country for every adult? Or are we just blowing words into the wind here?
No, I don't think we are. And I think for people to say that, people who want to break the law will break the law, so let's have no laws. I think that kind of rationale is it simply doesn't apply. We need to make sure that we are putting together legislation that keeps our communities safe. And I think that all people recognize that we want safe communities. I think all people recognize that you can be a gun owner that is responsible. I am a gun owner myself, and we know that we can have communities that are safe, that still allow gun owners the constitutional right to own a gun. But what we need to do is investigate the ways that we can keep our communities safe. And I think the place to begin is by investing in the research that will allow us to find out how we can use data to make good decisions.
You know, Mike, what about this notion that this country's in the midst of a mental health crisis and that's at the root of many of the mass shootings we've been forced to endure in this country? How would you approach this burgeoning mental health crisis in this country?
You know, I was actually, that was the notes I was just writing down I was going to go to next, because mental health, and from what I've been told and talking to professionals in the district, in the district, the capital D, as well as the school districts, is we are having a crisis in mental health, both among teens, in the general population. You know, what can we do? I mean, I asked this question just yesterday. I was over at KU talking to, I should probably look at my notes here, but the big thing I heard, the big message I got was that it was a lack of funding. It's a lack of inpatient beds. The number I got from this one particular hospital in Johnson County, there's only 52 beds and they're full basically all the time. I've heard from the police departments that one of the challenges they have when they deal with mental health challenges in the community, they need to hire co-responders because there's an element there. Then the issue they have is that what are they going to do with these folks? If they're doing something, they need to take care of them, then they end up in the emergency room. So, you know, the mental health issue is kind of the undercurrent problem that I think has just manifested itself by arming those folks with weapons. So I would agree with you there.
What would you do about mental health, Tom?
It is a critical issue that has to be addressed. This is something I've seen throughout my career, and this is something that affects students anywhere. My 22 years of experience in the public schools indicates that students from all backgrounds are susceptible to issues of mental health. And one of the things that we can do in our schools is to ensure that we've got adequate funding, to ensure that we've got safety nets in place for students who are struggling with these issues. And I think that that funding for mental health is something that has to be increased. We know that this is an increasing problem, and it requires the adequate funding to make sure that that the people who need services for mental health issues get those kinds of services.
Can I interject one last comment?
Yeah,
real quick?
Mike.
So when I was just looking back to my notes when I was over at Miralac the other day, one of the things that the director of operations told me there is that the pressure to be successful is never ending for teens. So it's not just in school, but it's also when we go home. So the example she gave is, you know, I'm older, I'm in my 50s. You know, when we went home from school every day, it was kind of time to unwind and turn off and go play in the neighborhood. Well, kids jump right back on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I even heard this also when I was on a ride along in the Overland Park Police Department that, you know, a kid will post something on social media and they don't instantly get 100 likes. They think all of a sudden they're not popular. So, or if there's a party this week and they find out at 3 o'clock in the morning they missed it, whereas before we were kids, we probably were completely oblivious to it. So, although let's put on record that Steve was invited to every party. I just want to make sure I lay that down.
I don't think so.
Well, I wasn't, but Steve was for sure. Social media plays a role in this too. And it kind of puts a red hot attention on this fact of always trying to be successful in life. And I think when people feel disenfranchised, they don't have places to go. And unfortunately, some of the kids have gone to the gun cabinet in their home.
You know, the ACLU, different topic here, has threatened to sue the Shawnee Mission School District over a school walkout in April that was part of a nationwide protest of gun violence. The allegation was that students' free speech rights were violated in the wake of those protests. Tom, did the district go too far or were students to blame here? How do you size it up?
The students were taking action on an issue that is directly relevant to their lives. And the students, I was very proud of the students' actions. And in fact, some of my students were some of those kids that organized those protests. And I think that those students understand very clearly their right to speak their mind about an issue that deeply affects their lives and the lives of their friends, the lives of the people in their communities. I think they had every right, the students had every right to express their opinion, and they should have been allowed to do so.
Mike, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, no issue there.
No.
Different topic. How important is preserving President Obama's Affordable Care Act, Mike?
Well, I think it's critical important. Everyone I talk to in the district believes that it was moving us in the right direction. I mean, we all agree that there's some things we could be fixing on it, but nonetheless, people believe it was going in the right direction. I would be supporting. I mean, I know personally, as a matter of fact, that, you know, my wife just recently navigated going through breast cancer treatment. My daughter has a chronic disease. So those two women in my life, you know, I know how important it is to have a healthcare system that doesn't lock you out because you have a pre-existing condition or you've passed a lifetime cap. So to me, those were the two core tenets. And then also the fact that everyone gets insurance were necessary steps towards having a more healthy country and a more perfect union. And I would absolutely support every measure to keep moving that that train forward in a way that gets more people coverage and keeps more people healthy.
Tom, you feel the same way?
I do. The Affordable Care Act needs to be protected. Before the Affordable Care Act came along, we could not afford the insurance premiums that were offered through my job. And we were denied insurance when I tried to buy independent insurance from other agencies. And it was due to pre-existing conditions. So I know firsthand what it's like to do everything right. You're playing by the rules, working as hard as you possibly can. and the cost of trying to provide health care for your family is financially ruinous. And the Affordable Care Act was an attempt to try and protect families from that. So it needs to be protected.
President Trump's trade war, Mike, how concerned are you about the impact this is going to have on Kansas farmers across the country?
Well, I do worry about it. But I actually have been thinking about this a lot lately, that I think this started a while ago, before some of those recent sanctions. And by the way, it doesn't just affect farmers. It also affects engineering firms in town, too. So you go talk to Burns and Mac. They'll tell you the cost of steel is something that's kind of – there's a lot of rebar
it
in buildings. There's a lot of rebar in infrastructure as well. So,
right.
To me, I think it's a very misguided strategy. Well, I don't even know if it's a strategy by the president. But, I mean, he started down this path already with this international climate kind of attitude, mm-hmm. you know, by calling – and I don't want to get bleeped here, but by calling certain countries, you know, that word –
Mm-hmm.
Which my son, who's in the Peace Corps, actually heard directly from someone local, because he's serving in Africa right now in Rwanda. It's this international climate, as Tom said, I mean, destabilizing is things that people don't – that's bad for business, for everybody's business. If you talk to Burns and Mac, they'll tell you the thing that is most frustrating to them is there's not continuity of funding. There's not stability in the marketplace. Trade wars don't increase continuity and increase stability. They make things more disruptive, which I think is bad for business.
Mm-hmm. How where are you on trade wars, Tom?
No one wins in a trade war, and I think the tariff policies that Trump has put forth are destabilizing on a number of fronts. The increase in tariffs on steel and aluminum will make a lot of products here in the United States that much more expensive.
But he says he's doing this for the long-term interests of the country to even the playing field with other nations.
Right, and I don't think that does that. And I think that for Trump to say that this is a matter of national security, I think is a stretch.
Yeah.
What he's doing is alienating allies that are important for us in developing coherent and stabilizing foreign policy. And when we start using tariff wars as a way to focus on some personal agenda rather than focusing on what we need to do to shore up alliances to make sure that our foreign policy is one that increases stability around the globe, then I think we're using trade policy in a way that it was not meant to be.
And
the
thing that's scary about this too is people don't always think through the unintended consequences of things. You know, if you want to get teenagers riled up, you know, if China decided to stop shipping iPhones to us, all of a sudden, like, you know, you want to talk about marching. I mean, I don't think it would dwarf the March for Our Lives effort. So, I mean, and again, it's our stake. It's our standing in the rest of the world. It's how we are perceived abroad. And there's also the economic piece of it, too. But there's a lot of unintended consequences that I think could be very, very negative. I know are very negative for us abroad, both in the nonprofit sector as well as in the for-profit sector.
You know, help a voter out here. Both of you are sort of even, Steven, on issue after issue here. How should a voter sort of sift out the differences and the distinctions between Mike McCammon and Tom Nierman? Help them out. What should they think, Mike, walking away from this conversation?
Well, first I'll say, if you're choosing between Tom and I think alphabetical is probably the most safest way you could probably pick somebody. No, I mean, the thing, you know, if you put 10 Democrats on a stage, we're going to have a lot of similar views. I mean, there's going to be some differences, but generally speaking, we're going to be relatively similar. So the way that I would make that decision...
Is it a personality contest?
No. Well, it can be, and it shouldn't be. What it should be is looking at what folks have done in their career and how that prepares them for this job of going to the Shark Tank. Okay, this is not a goldfish bowl in D.C. I mean, there are 535 people in Congress that all have different interests, that have all different objectives, and the question is what experience do you have in your life to do that?
Tom, I'll give you a few seconds to respond as well.
All right. Well,
very quickly.
Sure. I think what's really important here is that for me, the issues that are so important to our voters are issues that I'm personally familiar with. I've got a career of service to my community. I know what it's like to wrestle with gun violence. I know what it's like to wrestle paycheck to paycheck. I know what it's like to stare down these insurance costs. All of the things that are important to people are things that I've wrestled with personally. And I think that's important to have in a representative.
Tom Nierman, Mike McCammon, two Democratic candidates for Kansas's 3rd District. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back, Bobby Kennedy in Kansas. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow will mark 50 years since the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. He was the second son of the famed political family to run for the U.S. presidency. Today, we recall Bobby Kennedy with an edition of the Archiver podcast, hosted by KCUR's Sam Zeff. It explains how the senator from New York came to visit Kansas early on in his campaign.
If 2016 is the most tumultuous presidential election year you've ever seen, that simply means you weren't alive or paying attention in 1968. The year was marked by assassinations, a war in Vietnam that went from awful to worse, and bitter fights for the Democratic and Republican presidential nominations. Oh, and segregationist George Wallace from Alabama ran as an independent. The political craziness, though, really took off in March of that year. President Lyndon Johnson was wildly unpopular, and he was being challenged from the left by Senator Eugene McCarthy from Minnesota. On March 12th, the two battled to essentially a tie in New Hampshire. A week later, Robert F. Kennedy suddenly and unexpectedly entered the race. And then LBJ surprised the country during a nationally televised speech.
With American sons in the field far away, with America's future under challenge right here at home, I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes. Accordingly, I shall not seek the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
With a sitting president out of the race, the Democratic and Republican fields were wide open. And for a couple of days in mid-March, most political eyes settled on Kansas when RFK, the young senator from New York, showed up.
I don't know whether you're going to like what I'm going to say today, but I just want you to remember as you look back upon this day, and when it comes to a question of who you're going to support, that it was a Kennedy who got you out of class.
The podcast is Archiver. The episode, The Sudden Need to Run. Me, I'm your host, Sam Zeff. So first, a little bit about why Bobby got into the race and what drove LBJ out. Johnson won in a landslide in 1964, the biggest landslide, in fact, since Kansas Governor Alf Landon got pasted by FDR in 1936. In 64, Johnson had pushed through the most significant civil rights bill since the Civil War, and he was pushing his Great Society of package of social reforms, Medicaid, Medicare, federal funding for education. But as high as Johnson was riding in 64 and 65, that's how low his presidency sunk by 68. His approval rating was 35%. The last shreds of hope for Vietnam disappeared late in January with the Tet Offensive.
Vietnam. United States helicopter gunships backed up ground forces in a strong assault on a Viet Cong position only 3 miles from Saigon's Tan Son Nhut Air Base.
Students held hunger strikes in Boston in February protesting the war. The Black Panther Party was gaining prominence.
Parents want you to make money, go to school, have a nice job. I want to have a nice job. I'll do anything as long as I'm happy.
Anybody who doesn't have an ideal is never going to do anything or go anyplace.
LBJ was weak, but no big-name Democrat would step up to run against him. So Senator Eugene McCarthy from Minnesota got in the race as the anti-war candidate. LBJ ran in the New Hampshire primary and got 49% of the vote, but McCarthy shocked everyone and got 43%. And Johnson knew he was done. And in a move that would be inconceivable today, Bobby Kennedy announced on March 16th, just 5 months before the convention in Chicago, that he was running for president.
I run because I am convinced that this country is on a perilous course, and because I have such strong feelings about what must be done, and I feel that I'm obliged to do all that I can.
2 days later, RFK lands in one of the least likely places a brand new presidential candidate could go right out of the gate, Manhattan, Kansas. It wasn't a mistake or bad staff work that Bobby started his campaign in Ahern Fieldhouse on the K-State campus, of course. He had already agreed to do a landed lecture. The series is venerable now, but only a couple of years old in 1968. The title of his lecture, Conflict in Vietnam and at Home. He would make a day of it in Kansas, also addressing a packed Allen Fieldhouse at KU and making a stop at Haskell Indian Institute, as it was known at the time. Kennedy would talk about very serious topics, and we'll get to the politics behind his trip. But I want to take just a moment and talk about a couple of remarkable things about the introduction you just heard. Bobby was introduced by Republican Senator Jim Pearson, also on hand, Democratic Governor Robert Docking. A presidential candidate was in the state, and back then, that called for a little bipartisanship. But what most everyone wanted to hear RFK speak about was Vietnam. That was the reason he was in the race, and LBJ was on his way out. Here's what he had to say at K-State.
Most Americans are concerned that the course we are following at the present time is deeply wrong. I am concerned, as I believe most Americans are concerned, that we are acting as if no other nation existed against the judgment and the desires of neutrals and our historic allies alike. I am concerned that at the end of it all, there will be only more Americans killed, more of our treasure spent, and because of the bitterness and because of the hatred on every side of this war, more hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese slaughtered, so that they may say, as Tacitus said of Rome, they made a desert and they called it peace. I don't think that's satisfactory for the United States of America.
Kennedy would make some of the same remarks when he traveled to Lawrence, where they let kids out of school so they could attend the speech. But he also talked about other issues, issues that we still hear about today. Here he is in Allen Fieldhouse.
And if we seem powerless to stop this growing division between Americans who at least confront one another, there are millions more living in the hidden places whose names and faces are completely unknown. But I have seen these other Americans. I have seen children in Mississippi starving, their bodies so crippled from hunger, and their minds have been so destroyed for their whole life that they will have no future. I have seen children in Mississippi, here in the United States with a gross national product of $800 billion. I have seen children in the Delta area of Mississippi with distended stomachs, whose faces are covered with sores from starvation. And we haven't developed a policy so we can get enough food so that they can live, so that their children are not, so that their lives are not destroyed. I don't think that's acceptable in the United States of America, and I think we need a change. I have seen Indians living on their bare and meager reservations with no jobs, with an unemployment rate of 80%, and with so little hope for the future, so little hope for the future, that for young people, for young men and women in their teens, the greatest cause of death amongst them is suicide, that they end their lives by killing themselves. I don't think that we have to accept that. For the first American, for this minority here in the United States, that young boys and girls are so filled with despair when they're going to high school and feel that their lives are so hopeless and that nobody's going to care for them, nobody's going to be involved with them, and nobody's going to bother with them, that they either hang themselves, shoot themselves, or kill themselves. I don't think that's acceptable, and I think the United States of America, I think the American people, I think we can do much, much better.
So back with me is archiver historian Virgil Dean. Virgil, I want to talk a little bit about why Bobby Kennedy believed that the road to the White House for him went through young people and through college campuses. We know that Gene McCarthy had made his bones in the 68 campaign with young people. Do you think that's what that Kennedy knew, that the establishment Democrats may not be going for him and he had to go another route?
I think he believed he had to take over that movement in some ways, what was going on. And he certainly couldn't ignore the activism that was taking place. And Kansas was not immune to that. I mean, there was a lot of activity on Kansas campuses by at KU and K-State in particular by 68 in terms of civil rights protest activity and the anti-war, which would heat up in 68 and keep going into 1970 in particular. So 68, 69, and 70 were really big years for that.
Lawrence, Kansas in 1968 is really a hotbed of anti-war activity. I think we forget that. I think we sometimes remember that anti-war activity certainly on both coasts. But Lawrence was front and center in the Midwest. So in 1968, describe to me what was going on in Lawrence, Kansas in 1968.
Well, you do have quite a bit of activity on KU campus. I mean, I think in 66, there's a Vietnam War committee or a committee of a student committee that's formed for the first time that starts protests. Throughout 68 and 69, you have very active protest movement. And then Kennedy was also interested and had been for some time in all kinds of the underclasses in the country. And in particular, he'd been concerned about Native Americans or American Indians and reservations, the situation on reservations, which was pretty deplorable.
How old were you in 1968?
I was a junior in high school. I and a couple of other friends got in somebody's car. I'm sure it wasn't mine because my wheels weren't very good at the time. went to Lawrence to see Bobby Kennedy and hear his speech. Being in a very conservative Republican Kansas household family, I was not, at the time, a big supporter of the Kennedys. Pretty much reflected my dad's political ideology, but nevertheless had the chance to go, and it was a great experience.
So tell me about it. What do you remember?
Well, I remember the enthusiasm, I guess, more than anything. You just listening to this guy who I knew more because he was the brother of John F. Kennedy than anything else, and the first president I really remember is John F. Kennedy. I have vague memories of Eisenhower, but certainly John F. Kennedy and the assassination is imprinted on my mind in a big way.
When you talk to others who were at the speeches at K-State and KU, the memories are vivid. Bobby was like a rock star, you hear a lot. But for one young man from Kansas, the RFK lecture at KSU would change his life.
The first time I ever met Senator Kennedy was when I volunteered in his Washington, D.C. Senate office in 1966.
Now, I like to think of myself as a dyed-in-the-wool Kansan. Grew up in Overland Park, went to KU. Hate Wizard of Oz jokes. But compared to Dan Likens, a lawyer in Topeka, I barely rate. A native of Atchison, he went to K-State and Washburn Law. He served on both the Washburn Board of Regents and the Kansas Board of Regents. And not only was he there for Kennedy's speech at K-State, he was right down front and went on to work on the campaign. I talked with Likens in his office, where a corner is dedicated to RFK.
It was just, for Kansas, it was a very special day to have Robert Kennedy in our state. And 1968 was a sad time in our state, but our state played an important part of history. The last university Dr. King ever spoke at was Kansas State. The first university that Robert Kennedy ever spoke at after he announced for president was Kansas State, and that's my university. It really did change my life, because at that time I had no idea what I was going to do in the future, except I wanted to do something in politics, because I love politics. After Kennedy announced for president, I met some of his aides in Manhattan and told them I wanted to do something. I want to be involved in the campaign. So they said, why don't you organize colleges in Kansas to go up to Nebraska for the Nebraska primary? That's the next primary coming up. So after Kennedy left Manhattan in March, I started up, it was called Collegians for Kennedy. And we had numerous bus trips every weekend for the next 4 weeks going up to Nebraska. We had buses from Wichita State, from KU. I mean, the people that supported President Kennedy in Nebraska weren't Democrats. I was the president of the Young Democrats at Kansas State. Most of the people on those buses were Republicans, but they admired Senator Kennedy so much. And a lot of it was the anti-war sentiment, you know, the Vietnam War sentiment. So I decided we got to end this war. We got to do something different. And I thought, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it with Robert Kennedy. The last time I talked to Senator Kennedy was about a week before he died. I told him that I did not think I was going to be able to go to California because my uncle was dying of cancer. So I came home to be with my dying uncle. In a way, if I had not come back to see my uncle, I would have been in Los Angeles at that hotel, because wherever I was, the hotel is where Kennedy was. So I'm kind of glad I wasn't there that night. And then when I was in, I grew up in Atchison, that's where I was when I found out Kennedy had been killed. And so then I immediately decided, you know, I wanted to go to the funeral. So I went to New York, went to the funeral, and then I rode the Kennedy funeral train to Washington, D.C. Elsa Kennedy would go through the train and talk to people. I don't know how she kept up the way she did. But people on the train, you know, were just crying, the aides, and I was crying. As you can see, I got a letter from Ethel Kennedy up here that she wrote me, thanking me for helping, and I cherish that. It's on my wall right now. It says, "Dear Mr. Likens, thank you for all your hard work at the time of Bobby's funeral. Your help and support did so much to lighten our burden during those difficult days and made the final services for him a beautiful tribute. The children and I shall always remember the many people who came forward to help us when we needed them. And we send you our grateful thanks. Sincerely, Ethel Kennedy." I'm not sure who the next Kennedy may be or the Kennedy-like person, but I think there's somebody out there that is going to do what Kennedy was attempting to do and bring our country closer together, and let's stop all this fighting and work together. And I hope that comes soon.
If you read or listen to either of Robert Kennedy's speeches in Kansas on March 18, 1968, and I urge you to do so, I think you'll be struck by how the themes resonate today. But I also think you'll be struck by the writing. It's both clear and scholarly. Sometimes he even sounds like his brother. This is a passage from his K-State speech that I kept reading over and over. It comes pretty early, and he's just starting to talk about Vietnam. "Tragedy," he said, "is a tool for the living to gain wisdom, not a guide by which to live. Now as ever, we do ourselves best justice when we measure ourselves against ancient tests." And he goes on to quote the Greek play, The Antigone of Sophocles. "All men make mistakes, but a good man yields
when he knows his course is wrong, and he repairs the evil. The only sin," he says, "is pride."
You can find this and other archiver editions at FountainCityFrequency.com. Tomorrow, LGBTQ activists discuss the Kansas City Council's historic decision to include sexual orientation in the local civil rights ordinance. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.